remember, whenever you sow money, it doesn't mean you just put it in the bank. It means you put it where it can help others, where it can be a work of love. So this is the rule. We take what is necessary, the basic necessities of life, but we sow everything else. What is necessary, what is useful, relatively necessary in our occupation, but we sow everything else. Those are the necessary samples. This is the most perfect way to consecrate the good things of the world. You don't have to eat and drink them. You don't have to enjoy them. You have to enjoy them. People, that's why God gave us these good things to enjoy. He gave us enjoyable things, but he tells us also to sow them. So that's the first kind of samples. Now, there's another kind of samples we mentioned the other day, and that's what we call the captivating samples. There are certain samples that each of us like. We all have different tastes. And as the old lady said when she kissed the cow, our tastes are different. So we all have different tastes. What is your sample is not my sample, and vice versa. So we all have to make a choice. And this is what we have to find. As I said the other day, instead of looking for your particular vice, look for your particular sample. If your vice is avarice, your sample is money. Therefore, sow money. If your vice is gluttony, sow food. If your vice is vanity, sow clothing. If your vice is the comforts of life, sow the pleasures of the body. Sow these pleasures in order to reap the divine pleasure. Sow them as far as you can. You keep what is necessary. You sow everything else to reap the divine. So, the captivating samples. God wants us to love every creature. Wants us to love him above every creature. But he's not going to take us through the universe and show us every creature and say, do you love me more than this? Do you love me more than that? Do you love me more than this? It would take a long time. And so whenever you go into a department store, whenever you want to buy a coat, let us say, or a suit, the clerk takes a look at you. And let us say you go into a big store like Macy's or Horns or Coughlin's here in Pittsburgh. They have thousands of them. You can't try them all on. The season would be over before you've made your selection. So what the clerk does is to show you a rack just your size. They size you up and says, you see what you size you wear. They take you to the rack and they say, now on this rack or these racks, these are all your size. They're different styles, different colors. Now take your pick. And so you confine your choice there. Now that's what God does. He can't take us through the universe and show us every creature and ask us to make an act of preference, but he knows our size, so to speak. He knows our tastes. We have certain tastes, and this is the area in which we will be tried and tempted. This is why we have the same old temptation so often, why people be weary of the same old. Why do I have to go through this every day, constantly? You see, because that is your particular taste. And this is God's way of testing your love. Do you love me more than this sample? Things that you have no taste for, they wouldn't be a test. But do you love me more than this? So he does this over and over again. And he wants you to say those words that lovers always like to hear, I love you. I love you more than anything, more than anyone. I love you best of all. Our life, our trying, is a test of love. And God wants to hear that. When lovers can't say that anymore to one another, their love is dead. Their marriage is finished. And God wants us to say that as long as we live. We love you more than this. And so, these captivating samples, sometimes these captivating samples are all necessary samples. For example, food. And food is necessary as well as a great attachment. And so then we have to practice a real discernment and judgment and earnestness. We're really on the spot. We're really on the test there. To use what is needful, but not to overdo it. But these captivating samples are the field where we, each of us, can be tested, and we will be tested over and over and over and over again. As we suggested, even though you feel that your confessions are dull and dry and not interesting, we are not expected to go out and commit a fresh and original mortal sin every week, so you'll have something to say to your confessor. You see, you'll be the same old thing all your life, perhaps, because your temperament doesn't change at all. They're not just based on weakness. These tastes are based on your temperament, your emotional capacities, your emotional gifts. So we have to be ready to sow our captivating samples, the things we like most, in order to reap the things that we certainly will like better. And no matter how weary we become, you see, with these temptations, why, we must see them this way. God tests them. This is especially true of temptations against chastity. Now remember, we said that is the sweetest of all the samples. So that is one of the number one areas of temptation for practically everybody. Do you love me more than this sweet sample? Or are you going to choose the sample over me? That's the test. And that's the best test, because it's right in the area of love. It's right in that zone of love. A man who loves money more than a person is to be pitied. But he might be highly respected in the community. He might be president of the First National Bank. Whereas maybe the adulterer would be in jail, or the drunkard. But see, these temptations are right in the area of love, and that's what Christianity is all about, loving God. And so we have to be able to love God even above the most lovable samples that would draw us away from God. Even the most precious samples. And their persons, their marriage, sexual union, that's the sweetest of the samples. So God can't relieve you of those temptations. He would be saying, I don't want your love, but he does want your love. And we have to go through them and be able to say over and over and over again, God, I choose you first. You are first. Now there's another kind of samples. They're what we call forbidden samples. They're the sins. They're the sins that we can commit. There's certain samples God says no to. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. Life is good, but we're not supposed to take anybody else's life. The things of this world are good, but we must not steal them. Thou shalt not commit adultery. There's only six of those commandments. You know, we sometimes say, oh, the commandments are all so negative. But there's only six classifications of things that we're not supposed to touch, of things of these forbidden samples. There's not that many. But they are forbidden, and therefore under pain of sin. They're good things. To say they're forbidden doesn't mean they're evil. It means they're good. Like money. Money we need for orphanages, for churches, but we're supposed to get it by hard work. Wealth without work is one of the seven sins that Gandhi went. Those seven sins are listed on that sign over there. Somebody put that sign up from a previous retreat. Don't forget to get them. There are those seven sins of Gandhi. That's a beautiful listing. He has great insight. And that's one of them. Wealth without work. Worship without sacrifice. That's another one that we ought to think of. Worship without sacrifice. Think of them all. These captivating samples are then to be sown in order to get the joys of heaven. We sow earthly joys to get the joys of heaven. Things that we love most. And so we have to expect this kind of trial always. Now, oh, the forbidden samples we're on now, we complain about them too. We say that they're so negative. Christianity is so negative. That's often a complaint. And this is, I was interested in reading this column in the paper by Sidney Harris. Sidney Harris is a good pagan, and a very good pagan, and he has lots of wisdom, lots of natural wisdom. He's favorable towards Christianity, but he's not a Christian, as far as I know, or not a Jew, by practice. And he had the column that was caused, the positive is more restricting than the negative. That's a paradoxical statement. The positive is more restricting than the negative. Now, what's he mean? I can only explain you by an example. Suppose that the tourist department of Pennsylvania wants to give all you visitors a good time, and they decide to point out every attractive feature in Pennsylvania. They put signs up. And you go along the road and you say, to the left, a beautiful elm tree. To the right, a beautiful oak tree. You know, there would be no end to it. And they really would clutter up the environment by putting all those signs up, you see. You couldn't possibly point out all the beautiful things in Pennsylvania, even in the Pittsburgh area. Couldn't possibly be done. But so they content themselves with a few signs. Dangerous curves, bad crossing, rock slides. They're ugly signs. You better not be have sea signs along there. But they're warning you against dangers, and a few of them are sufficient. They don't hurt the pleasure of your trip. They make the trip possible. And so it is with the negative commandments. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not bear false witness. It makes life possible and pleasant. If we all were stealing from one another all the time, all thieves, and nothing was safe anywhere, life would not be possible. Pleasurable life would not be. If we were all killing one another at will, as some people want to do, we wouldn't have any kind of life. If we were all interfering with the domestic happiness and domestic arrangements of our neighbors and taking a wife or a husband, a man or a woman, wherever we wanted it, well, life would not be possible. These things protect our life. So like a commandment like thou shalt not commit adultery, that's like a man that would put a sign has an estate, and in front of the estate there's a sign that says no trespassing. Does that mean he hates his property? That he doesn't want anybody to see it? That it's not worth looking at? No, it means it's so beautiful and so desirable that he wants to protect it. And so he says, thou shalt not trespass. The negative is intended to protect the positive, and that's true of all the commandments. Thou shalt not steal means those things are good, and they belong to somebody else. Hands off. You see, thou shalt not kill. Life is precious. That's the positive side. We forget the positive side. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Marriage is precious. The family is sacred, and sex is inextricably connected with the love of the family. Therefore, hands off all those who are unwilling to accept the responsibilities of marriage, hands off. That's the negative side, but the positive side is the beauty of sex and the beauty of married life. So these are the forbidden samples. Now there's one more class of samples, and they're what we call the indifferent samples. The indifferent samples. And that's a big class, and that's important because that becomes a good area for our sowing too. We speak of certain actions which are indifferent. In a wider sense, we can distinguish ethically or morally, three kinds of actions. Actions which are inherently good, like almsgiving, fasting, and prayer, they are inherently good. They're the best on the one side. And then on the other side are actions which in Catholic morality are considered inherently evil. Stealing, lying, swearing falsely, adultery, and such like. These are inherently evil. These are actions which we cannot sanctify. We can sanctify anything which is naturally good, whether you eat or drink or whatever else you do, do all for the glory of God. But things which are inherently evil cannot be sanctified. They are sinful. They're outside the area of sanctification. And while some people want to change that, they still stand those Ten Commandments of the Lord. And they're the basic, as we said, they're the floor, they're the lowest degree of love. And no new morality can justify their breaking, much as we want. We have all kinds of evasions. Rich people have all kinds of, we have rich thieves as well as poor thieves, and they have all kinds of justifications for embezzlement and for gaining money, like Mr. D'Orléans has been in much in the news much lately. You see, he needed millions, and he got it any way he wanted it. So money is so precious, we can do anything we want. That's part of our ethics. We only admire them because they're so clever. We just pity them whenever they get caught, because that was unfortunate. But we then between the good actions and the bad actions were what we call indifferent actions. A person might come to a priest and say, "Father, is it a sin to drink beer? Or is it a sin to dance? Or is it a sin to smoke?" These are actions which would be called indifferent. You see, so the priest would say, "Oh no, they're indifferent action. Don't worry about them." And then the person takes that as a license to go ahead and drink as much as they want, smoke as much as they want, and dance as much as they want, and without any precautions. And they're very likely to fall into sin, because the love of the creatures leads to sin. Natural motives lead to sin. People say, "Oh, that's indifferent." What about these indifferent actions? Well, there are indifferent actions, what we call indifferent. What ethicist means by an indifferent action is an action which has no inherent or built-in morality. Almsgiving has a built-in morality. It's good. Adultery has a built-in morality. It's bad. Interfering with the happiness of another family. It can't be justified. Even whenever the situation ethicists bring up questions like the Nazis, you know, the Nazis demanding a wife intercourse from a woman in order to spare her husband, that doesn't justify that act of adultery. It's still an act of adultery. We can justify the woman because she's acting under coercion. We don't need to change the law to justify her. I don't know how that ever affected Catholics, because I've always known that as a priest, that to make a sin there has to be full consent and full deliberation. And if a person does something which is material evil without full consent, it's not a sin. Or without being capable. So cases like this that were brought up by Joseph Fletcher, they are irrelevant. They're outside the law. And the same way, there are certain types of stealing. A man who is starving and he takes something is not considered to be stealing. Never was. Because life comes before the right of property. The right to life is prior to the right of property. The law won't respect that, and some poor devil that steals something for a starving family might be thrown into jail. But this is the morality that would accept it. So, these indifferent actions. Now let's take them. My point is, actually there's no such thing in the concrete. In actual practice, there is never a morally indifferent action. And whenever we say there are indifferent actions, we're talking in the theoretical or the abstract order. Let me take an example. Walking is a sample of an indifferent action. It has no inherent morality. Walking as such is neither good nor bad. But walking doesn't exist as such. Could you take a photograph of walking or drinking? No. You take a photograph of someone who is walking. There's a person walking, and that person is walking in this direction or that direction. Walking in one direction, he might be going to a church. That is no longer an indifferent action. It's a good action. He's going to do a work of mercy. That is no longer a good, an indifferent action. That's a good action. Even if he's interrupted and is not able to complete his work of mercy or get to the church, he still, in his mind, has performed a good and a meritorious action. Or if he's walking to go down to the tavern in order to get drunk, then that's an evil action. If he's walking down to the tavern, it's not an evil action, but it's a risky action, especially if he is addicted to liquor. See, in the concrete, there is no such thing as an indifferent action. And by in the concrete, I mean an action in practice, in absolute reality or actuality. Every action is clothed with circumstances. And these circumstances will determine the morality of that action. We must examine the circumstances. This is situation ethics. And there's always been a situation ethics in Catholic moral teaching. At least when I studied. And sometimes we didn't look at the circumstances sufficiently, and we took it for granted that missing Mass on Sunday was a missed sin, but there are circumstances that made missing Mass not sinful. There were some circumstances that might make missing Mass virtuous. To miss Mass to save a dying person, let us say. To go on an errand of mercy to save someone. Missing Mass then would be a virtuous act. So circumstances can alter cases, although missing worship is required by the law of God. So we have to distinguish that. So when somebody comes to me and says, is smoking a sin, and I say it's an indifferent action, I'm saying something truthful, or it used to be truthful. I don't know whether we can consider smoking anymore as an indifferent action. Whenever I was young, we did consider it that. When I was in the seminary, we caught that an indifferent action. But I just read in this morning's paper, you see, I took a glance at the headline, big headlines, that doctors claim that passive smoking doubles the risks of cancer. Passive smoking is sitting in a room where somebody else is smoking and blowing it in your face. Doubles the risk of cancer and heart disease. We hear all these things, you see, and we cannot think that smoking, whether active or passive even, we sometimes, I think, with courtesy, would demand that we put up with it with a neighbor. It becomes pretty hard when they're blowing in your face in a bus or a streetcar or a restaurant. But even this, you see, it's risky. It's no longer, it's inherently evil, really, I think now. It has some evil with it. And the same way with drinking. I think this is the way the church has lost tens of thousands of young people, especially young men, with that idea that drinking is indifferent. And then they take that as a signal, go ahead and drink as much as you like. Or even if you don't say drink as much as you like, that's what happens, because, as we said, temperance is difficult. I thought by moderation to overcome evil, precisely by moderation, I was overcome by evil. Many could say that, beside Baudelaire. How many cocktails are moderate? Pretty hard to judge it mathematically, and first, before you've made the judgment, why, you're gone. So, drinking may be indifferent, but it can be good. We use wine at Mass. Jesus made the problem more poignant, because he provided wine. He might have provided apple cider or something like that, but he actually wants wine. And the church insists on the wine. So he makes the problem a little bit worse for us. Oh, anyway, to bring it down to this, you see, if I'm a priest in a parish and a woman comes into the parish office and she has a little boy with her, and she sees, suppose I'm a hunter, and on the wall of my study there's a gun. And a little boy sees the gun, and while we're talking about her grave problems, that little boy is wandering around with his eyes on that gun on the wall. And she gets nervous. She knows Jackie. And she gets nervous, and she says, Father, is that gun loaded? And I say, well, now, Mrs. Jones, be calm. As long as that gun's on the wall, it can't hurt your son. Now, she's not an idiot. She knows that without my telling her that on the wall. But she knows Jackie, too. And what she's afraid of, he'll get her off the wall. Will it hurt him then? Concretely, in actual practice. That's the difference between actuality and in the abstract, you see. And whenever a person asks me, was it a sin to drink? And I say it's an indifferent. I'm misleading them. It can be sinful. Now, you'll find out all this worked out beautifully for you in a number of chapters in the classic work of St. Francis de Sales, Introduction to the Devout Life, where he talks about recreations, and he talks about indifferent actions, and he tells you that they are good or bad according to their circumstances. That includes dancing. When I was a younger priest, we weren't allowed to have dances in parish halls. Now all the holes are barred, and we had rapes in the dormitory of a Catholic university here in the last couple of weeks because, you see, the sexes mix freely in the dormitories. We've taken off all guards, all prohibitions. This is for our freedom, to guarantee our freedom. It also guarantees such things as rapes and drunkenness and drug addiction. No control over such things, human nature being what it is. So this is the area of indifferent actions, and therefore you should remember that in practice there is no such thing as an indifferent action. On the wall, they may be all right, walking or drinking or smoking, but in practice, we have to judge by their circumstances, and they may be evil, and they very often are evil. Dancing, says St. Francis de Sales, usually takes place at night. Under the cover of night, anything can happen. We have even given up all chaperonage. When I was a chaplain at two Catholic colleges and they had dances there, they were done under surveillance of sorts. The young men were searched. That was the jazz age or after it, whenever drinking was popular among youngsters. So they had to be frisked to see if they were carrying flasks. The young women were examined by the lay faculty to see if their clothing was suitably modest. Now we have no guards or anything about that. And we wonder why there are teenage pregnancies, why there is an increase in teenage venereal disease. And the only way we control it is to give them more contraceptives and approve their abortions without any question. And we have provided them with absolutely no moral training or formation. So these are the things to think of when we think of indifferent actions. Let's adjourn, and we'll meet again at 10:45.